This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
May 7th, 1994. Jerry and Joyce. For the Sorbonne. On page 4 of Richard Ellman's biography of Joyce, he asks a number of hypothetical questions of the reader. The answer to each of these questions is supposed to be James Joyce alone. Had Ellman been familiar with Jerry's oeuvre, he would have realized that his supposition was incorrect. For example, he asks, what other hero in the novel has, like Stephen Dedalus, lice? Answer, Sengel, hero of days and nights. He is disinfected along with his entire regiment because of the prevalence of lice. And in fact, lice show up as often in Jerry's stories as they do in Joyce's. Ellman asks, what other hero defecates like Bloom before our eyes? Answer, Jerry's Marine Bishop Mendacious, hero of chapter 40 of Faustro. Indeed, he not only defecates like Bloom, but like Bloom he reads while defecating. And Jerry has him reading a piece by an untalented scribbler who actually lived, Pierre Loti, just as Joyce has Bloom reading a piece by an untalented scribbler who actually lived, Philip Beaufoy. And like Joyce, Jerry gives us a mixture of the story as it goes through the bishop's consciousness, interspersed with descriptions of events not connected with the story or the water closet, interspersed with a graphic description of the biological function underway. Where Bloom worries about a recurrence of piles being brought on by constipation and extols the virtues of an oral laxative, Jerry's character makes reference to piles of less efficacious suppositories. Ellman asks, what other hero masturbates? In the Supermail, there is the vivid description of a man who, quote, all his life, and he is still alive, has given himself up almost uninterruptedly to sexual acts, but in solitude, which explains a lot, unquote. To be sure, this is not a hero, but noteworthy in this compilation of parallels. Writes of Joyce on the same page, if we go to him to find a defender of the family, he presents his central hero, the cuckold. Jerry's Claudius is the central male in his novel, Messalina. He is a world-class cuckold. And Jerry's central hero, Pa Ubu, in the second of the Ubu plays, is a cuckold. In fact, the play is titled Ubu Cuckolded. Ellman tells of Joyce's, quote, unexpected fusings between beauty and its opposite. When Livia Svevo heard that Joyce in Finnegan's Wake was using her flowing hair as a symbol of the lovely River Liffey, she was flattered. But when she heard that in the river were two washerwomen scrubbing dirty linen, she was disgusted. To Joyce, the juxtaposition was easy and natural. The river is lovely and filthy. Dublin is dear and dirty, unquote. End of quote. Jerry in Faustro talking of the juxtaposition of the two signs, minus ostentative of woman and plus which is male, informs us that they are all the more identical because they are contrary. In fact, the identity of opposites as an idea plays a crucial role in all of Jarry's work. Describing what he considered a work of genius, Jarry wrote, "Every meaning which the reader may find therein is intentional, and he will never find them all, and the author can point them out to him. A victim in a game of intellectual blind man's bluff, unexpected, subsequent, and contradictory meanings," unquote. This, incidentally, is only one of dozens of Jarry statements which sound as though they were specifically describing Joycean methodology as we know it in the late works. While on the subject of Jarry's dictum, they were opposite, that is to say, identical, I'll point out that Ellman, on the same page, tells us that Joyce brings opposite ends of the mind together. Yet, he reminds us that, quote, "If we go to him thinking he may be the apostle of brotherhood, he shows us brothers in violent quarrel," unquote. The very first chapter of Jarry's Days and Nights pictures not a quarrel, but an outrageous contest between two brothers. Valens and his sex partner, Margot, is trying to outscore Sengo with his sex partner, Ilane. Jarry describes it as a bet, complete with a blackboard on which they keep a running tally. Ellman writes, "Joyce is the porcupine of authors." Jarry before him could have been so described to an even greater degree. Ellman writes, "His heroes are not easy liking." Here, too, one has only to think of Pa Ubu and his murderous better half, Ma, to realize, Ma Ubu, to realize this too is more deserved by Jarry than by Joyce. Quoting Ellman, "His books are not easy reading, nor are Jarry's. Faustjol is a work of such difficulty that Jarry added this addendum to the completed manuscript. This book will not be published integrally until the author has acquired sufficient experience to savor all its beauties in full." Ellman, "He does not wish to conquer us, but have us conquer him." Again, probably even more true of Jarry's oeuvre, taken as a whole, than of Joyce's. Ellman points to the thousands of phrases garnered mostly from undistinguished friends with which he filled his books. This recalls Jarry's line, "There is great wisdom in modeling one's soul on one's concierge." In fact, a concierge is among the undistinguished friends of Joyce that Ellman lists, along with waiters, hotel porters, etc. In October of last year, I exhibited in a New York gallery the 1,700-page manuscript I've been working on for the past several years on Duchamp, on Jarry in Duchamp and Jarry in Joyce. I'll read, unedited, the press release to the Joyce part of the exhibit. Anastasi's text states that James Joyce used Jarry's ideas and imagery promiscuously, sans acknowledgement, as a spur to his own genius in Finnegan's Wake and to a lesser degree in Ulysses, that he knew that Duchamp was fishing from the same pond, that Duchamp served as model for Burrus in Finnegan's Wake, that Joyce in the Wake refers to Jarry as me inner man monophone, me alter ego in miniature, the Midas Penny on the shadow of a post, the most important man, and that Joyce describes his debt to Jarry with, "I have the highest respect of anyone in my own smooth way for that intellectual debtor obligato. Mark my use of you cog, take notice how I employ, beware as you I foil." Copy. In the half year that has passed, my research leads me to modify only one thing. I am not so sure now that Jarry's presence is less in Ulysses than in Finnegan's Wake. I would also point out that I do not believe now, nor did I then, that Duchamp was the only model for Burrus, Actually, as we all know, there are probably few, if any, characters in Finnegan's Wake based on one individual. That said, I will add that I believe that Shem, also known as Jerry, is probably based in the largest part on Jerry, to a lesser degree on Joyce himself, and that Joyce, in some passages, seems to treat Jerry as his own twin or double or alter ego, in other passages as his spiritual father. Because of time considerations, however, I will concentrate on the correspondences I find between a section of the Circe chapter in Ulysses and the works of Jerry. Stephen, half drunk in a brothel, uses... Oh no, I gotta stop. This scene was chosen for this presentation because it is powerful, highly relevant to the entire story, and is likely to be remembered by anyone who has read the novel. Stephen, half drunk in a brothel, sees a hallucination of his dead mother appearing just as her cadaver would look after years in the grave, but alive and speaking. He asks her eagerly, "Tell me the word, mother, if you know now, the word known to all men." Instead of answering, she reminds him of the loving care she lavished on him when he was a child, begs him to repent, raises her blackened, withered arm towards Stephen's breast with outstretched fingers, saying, "Beware God's hand." A green crab with malignant red eyes strikes deep its claws into Stephen's heart. Stephen, strangled with rage, shouts, "Shite!" Bloom, also in the room, says, "What?" Stephen continues, "Ah, none par exempla. With me, all or not at all, none servia, that is, I will not serve." The mother continues in the same vein, "Save him from hell. Have mercy on Stephen, Lord, for my sake. Inexpressible was my anguish when, expiring with love, grief, and agony, Stephen shouts, 'Nothung,' that is, nothing with a U instead of an I, as well as the German word for needful, which is the name for the magic sword in Wagner's Ring, the sword which is shattered, reforged by Siegfried, and with which Siegfried unwittingly brings about Die Götterdämmerung, that is, the end of the world. As Stephen speaks, he lifts his cane high with both hands and smashes the chandelier. Time's livid final flame leaps, and in the following darkness, ruin of all space, shattered glass and toppling masonry. This scene, the pages leading up to it, and the pages immediately following, together have scores of images taken from Jerry, mostly from two scenes in the Supermail and from the Ubu plays. I'll treat the most visible connections first. Stephen asks his mother to tell him the word known to all men. When she ignores his question and preaches to him instead, he shouts, "Shite," which is an alternate spelling of the English word shit, which has one additional letter. Alfred Jarry's play Ubu Wa opens with Ubu shouting the word Merdre, that is, your word for shit with one letter added. And it certainly was the one word known to all men of a literary bent at that time. First acclaimed in 1896, it was, in my opinion, the big bang with which Jerry started our 20th century avant-garde 4 years ahead of schedule. Note as well that Stephen's one-word line, which immediately precedes his smashing of the chandelier, is nothing. Well, the first line of Jari Zubu Enchained, spoken by Ma Ubu, is, "What? You say nothing, Pa Ubu? Surely you haven't forgotten the word." The word Ma Ubu is referring to is Merdre, by now famous throughout the world, at least the world of literature. We have here a quadruple connection, at the least. Ma's first utterance of the play has the word nothing. Stephen shouts, "Nothing." Ma says, "Surely you haven't forgotten the word." Stephen asks his mother if she remembers the word. Pa Ubu, at Ma Ubu is Ma. Stephen's mother is Ma. The one-word sentence which with Ma Ubu opens the play is "What?" The one-word sentence spoken by Bloom in immediate response to Stephen's shite is "What?" And a final connection. Joyce has Stephen's nothing, followed by this description. He lifts his ash plant high with both. I'll repeat. He lifts his ash plant high with both hands and smashes the chandelier. Time's livid final flame leaps, and in the following darkness, ruin of all space, shattered glass, and toppling masonry, unquote. Well, before Jerry's Ubu Enchained even starts, before Ma Ubu gets to say, "You say nothing, Pa Ubu," Jerry has this introduction on the title page. Quote, "Pa Ubu, Pa Ubu, horn strumpet, we shall not have succeeded in demolishing everything unless we demolish the ruins as well. And the only way I can see of doing that is to use them to put up a lot of nice, well-designed buildings." Unquote. Joyce has ruin of all space, shattered glass, and toppling masonry. Jerry suggests that we won't succeed in demolishing everything unless we demolish the ruins as well. I'll proceed to give some of the other correspondences. The first scene from the supermail that I'll treat is the scene in which Markoy, the supermail, disguised as the Indian, ravishes a willing Ellen Elson 82 times in 24 hours to prove a point. This ravishment scene takes place with seven whores in attendance. We find the same number of whores present in Jerry's Nighttown scene. Stephen's reason for exploding and breaking the chandelier is complex. On the surface, it seems a reaction to his mother's ignoring his passionate question and giving a sermon instead of an answer. But the reader knows that, in fact, Stephen feels intense guilt about his mother's death. This runs throughout the book. You might say it's the most important fact in the book. On the third page of the text, we have, "The aunt thinks you killed your mother."
He said, that's Mulligan. That's why she won't let me have anything to do with you. Someone killed her, Stephen said gloomily. So that the reader knows that this smashing of the chandelier is no simple flying off the handle because his mother's shade changes the subject when he asks if she knows the word. It is intensely tied to deep feelings of guilt. It is almost in the shape of an inversion. Stephen's guilt is so great that the more expected reaction upon seeing and hearing the source of this guilt, seeing and hearing in the flesh, the source of this guilt would be for him to fall on his knees and beg forgiveness. Instead, he blows his lid, saying, I will not serve. Now a detour. Those familiar with Jerry's life story know that his biographers agree every one of his heroines represents his own real-life mother. Symbolize his own real-life mother. Which, you might say, is a measure of how passionately, which is a measure of how passionately he was tied to his mother in life. And now, quoting Beaumont's biography, Keith Beaumont's biography. For weeks on end in the early spring of 1893, Caroline Jarry had remained by her son's bedside during a grave illness, nursing him back to life and health from the brink of death, only to die herself a short time later as a result of illness and exhaustion. Jarry never got over the sense of loss which her death produced, and it is possible also that he was afflicted by a lifelong sense of guilt born of the idea that she had given her life for his, and that he was, as a result, albeit unwittingly and unwillingly, responsible for her death or murder. End of quote. It is clear that Joyce was very familiar with Jarry's life story, as well as with his oeuvre. Conceivably, the story in Ulysses of Daedalus' relationship to his deceased mother is a composite picture made up of all the biographical elements, as well as of elements from Jarry's life story and legend, as well as from elements of Jarry's life story and legend. This fits in well with our conviction that at some point, with my conviction that at some point Joyce began to see Jarry as a kind of secret double or alter ego. Remember, both were brought up intensely Catholic, in addition to this intense relationship with the mother. Just as Jarry never got over the loss of his mother, Stephen Daedalus has clearly not got over the loss of his mother. And no one questions that Stephen's mother is drawn to a great extent on Joyce's own mother. It seems clear that this parallel between the two writers was of fundamental significance to Joyce. Also, Joyce, in his life, openly expressed disdain for his Jarry in his life openly expressed disdain for his father. And Joyce in Ulysses likewise seems to betray a bias against Stephen's father, Simon. He's somewhat of a blowhard, mostly for effect, and whatever substance there is spoiled by a hard-bitten cynicism. Ellman paints a picture of greater affection by son for father than Joyce's description between Stephen and Simon. It is possible that Joyce's picture...
Telephone.
Whatever substance on Hargill's synthesis. It is possible that Joyce's picture of Stephen's relationship with his father, as in the case of his depiction of Stephen's mother, is somewhat fictionalized, using Jarry's, as in the case of his depiction of Stephen's mother, is somewhat fictionalized, using Jarry's relationship with his father as a partial model. I'll return to the chandelier breaking scene to show its connection with Jerry. In the Superman, Andre Marcoy will ravish a willing Ellen Elson 82 times in 24 hours to win an argument. Remember that Marcoy, the Supermale, represents Jerry himself, and that Ellen represents his real-life mother. Jerry writes, "Midnight struck. The clock must have been immediately above the gallery, for its booming filled the long room. The chandelier swayed, the picture frames trembled, and near the ceiling a pane of glass vibrated." End of quote. Unquote. And after the 24-hour love marathon, Jerry writes, quote, wrote, "And the young woman's breath murmured in a kiss that made his ears buzz. At last, we're through with the betting to please. Now let's think of ourselves. We haven't yet made love for pleasure." She has double-bolted the door. Suddenly, near the chandelier, a window pane shattered and the glass showered down on the rug. Unquote. Repeatedly in Jerry, when there is sexual intercourse of high relevance to the story, it is accompanied by shattered glass or cracking glass. This is not only true in the Supermale, it's true in Days and Nights, it's true in Messalina. Signaling the beginning of the 24-hour sexual marathon, midnight strikes. It strikes again at the end of the 24 hours. At the end of the 24 hours. The first 12 chimes are described as so close and booming that the chandelier sways and a pane of glass vibrates. The second 12 chimes, 24 hours later, are described as a miserable little tinkle, a miserable little tinkling thing that midnight exhausted, that little thing, midnight, exhausted its 12 strokes in the decrepit Laurence clock tower. The principals are no farther from the chimes now than they were before, but since they are exhausted by their sexual athletics, the chimes, too, are described as exhausted. In Circe, after the prostitute Zoe first appears, has a seduction scene with Bloom, then disappears, her disappearance is followed by this stage direction. Midnight chimes from distant steeples. This is one of numerous instances in which Jerry imagery will crop up in Joyce with a detail inverted. Jerry's chimes are so close that, as first described, their booming causes the chandelier to sway, the pane of glass to vibrate. After the record has been broken, and Ellen surprises Marcoy and us by asking for more, the same window pane shatters glass down on the rug. This is not good. A cane in a whorehouse has clear symbolic connections with an erected penis. Marcoy believes he has killed Ellen. Marcoy, symbolic of Jerry, believes that he has killed Ellen, symbolic of Jerry's mother, with his erected penis, that he has, to put it bluntly, fucked her to death. We know that Stephen is guilty because he believes that he has killed his mother. The coincidence of shattering glass in the two scenes is surrounded by an army of supporting correspondences. Jerry describing Ellen, the young woman's breath murmured. Joyce describing the mother's face sending out an ashen, the young woman's breath murmured. Joyce describing the mother's face sending out an ashen breath. Stephen's mother has smoldering eyes, and a crab with malignant red eyes sticks deep its claws in Stephen's heart. Ellen stares at her lover with hostile eyes, tying with smoldering eyes, in a scene where, enraged, she is trying to stick a pin in her lover's eyes, giving us a connection between Joyce's malignant red eyes and Jerry's hostile eyes, as well as between Joyce's sticks deep its claws with Jerry's line, "She drew from her hair a long sword-shaped pin, and vengeance bent, aimed it at Marcoy's eyes, which were shining on a level with her own." The pin is trying to stick deep, as Joyce's crab does, and we see Marcoy's shining eyes, which also connect with Stephen's mother's, with the mother's Stephen's mother's smoldering eyes. Jerry describing Ellen when Marcoy believes he has killed her. Quote, she fell back on the bed. Through her clenched teeth, her breath made the same imperceptible bubbling sound that is made by crabs. Here, Jerry's crabs ties directly to Joyce's crab. And Joyce soon describes the mother as having a green rill of bile trickling from the side of her mouth, which matches with Jerry's, quote, imperceptible bubbling sound coming through Ellen's clenched teeth. Again, possibly an inversion. Ellen has teeth, and Stephen's mother is toothless. Stephen, just before this description, says, they said I killed your mother. Jerry, telling of Marcoy looking at Ellen's body. Ellen was no longer breathing. Her heart was no longer beating. Her feet and hands were as glacial as the dawn. He would never have seen her. He would never have seen her if she had not been dead. In fact, Ellen, if she had not been dead, and indeed it would not be exaggerating to say that Stephen, seeing his horrific, horrific dead mother before him, is in a sense seeing her for the first time. In fact, Ellen wears a mask for the entire ravishment, just as Stephen's mother appears in her torn bridal veil. Ellen at one point says, I'm so hot. Zoe, who also connects with Ellen at numerous points, Jerry's Zoe, at Joyce's Zoe, who also connects with Ellen at numerous points, says, I'm melting. Two lines later, Stephen's mother says, oh, the fires of hell. Jerry writes of the unconscious Ellen, thought to be dead by Marcoy. Quote, she had kept her promise, her mask had fallen, but large circles had replaced it around her eyes. And Joyce tells us that Stephen's mother, quote, fixes her blue circled hollow eye sockets on Stephen. She opens her toothless mouth, uttering a silent word, which is another tie with Jerry's ma-u-bu and her reference to an unspoken word, as well as to Jerry's imperceptible bubbling sound made by crabs. We can clearly see how Joyce is dealing simultaneously with the microcosmic details. If the symposium gave me 20, if the symposium was 24 hours long, like Jerry's Love Marathon or Joyce's Bloomsday, I'd have a hard time describing all of the connections similar to the few I've given. We can clearly see how Joyce is dealing simultaneously with the microcosmic details of his own life and struggle, guilt over his mother's death and so forth, and the macrocosmic questions of life, art, and death. The breaking of the chandelier followed by the images, of time's livid final flame, ruin of all space, shattered glass, and toppling masonry. He's hinting here at the apocalypse, the end of the world. The tie here is directly to the supermale whose world ends with his belief that he has killed Ellen, and a little later, literally, with an explosion. And it ties as well to Jerry's introductory phrase for Ubu and Change, we shall not have succeeded in demolishing everything unless we demolish the ruins as well, but the only way I can see of doing that is to use them to put up a lot of fine, well-designed buildings. written in 1900, this would be Jari's greeting to our century. He is saying we must cease worshiping the past. Before we can begin to make a new beauty, we must demolish the encrusted tradition of the past. We must demolish the encrusted tradition and even demolish the ruins. Then we can begin. And that is exactly what he did with his Faustro and Days and Nights, and exactly what Joyce did with Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake. When Stephen, instead of kneeling to his mother's shade, says, non serviam, says, I will not serve, and instead of worshiping her memory, proceeds to wreck the joint, we're seeing an almost literal acting out of Jarry's anarchical advice. I believe we are eyewitnesses here to a scene which represents the central and primal battle between the two sides of James Joyce. On the one hand, the sensitive, religiously inclined, mother-worshipping, and dutiful son. On the other, the independent, titanic artist, willing to reject and even crush the seductive nostalgia and sentimentality connecting him with the past in order to fulfill his destiny and the promise of the future of art. And I believe without question, the life and example of Alfred Jarry acted as an inspiration and a support and support in that battle. In his life, Joyce compensated for any residual guilt towards his mother by remaining loyal to his wife for decades after having confessed to an intimate that the word love made him want to throw up. But in his art, he threw in with Jarry, a heretic, a blasphemer, a lunatic genius, and the one artist above all in our era who personifies the word iconoclast. Joyce's reasons for keeping this posthumous love affair private are not difficult to imagine. He had enough troubles with the Blue Noses already without championing this open homosexual at a time when they were still throwing such people in jail in England. Any feelings of latent homosexuality which he might have harbored consciously. What page are we? 14. Where's 15? Consciously or otherwise, would have fed the desire for secrecy. Would have not fed, but would have shored up the desire. Shored up the desire for frequency, for secrecy. And ironically, his public posture was always to appear apart from the extreme avant-garde, just as Duchamp consistently resisted being identified with the Dadaists.